Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the committee to order. Quorum is present. And the first order of business is to move the minutes of March 18th, 19th, and 21st.
Madam
Those
Chair.
Are in the packet. So Representative Benson.
I would move all three minutes.
All right. Representative Benson moves the minutes of March 18th, 19th, and 21st. Any discussion of the minutes? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay, the first bill on the agenda today, members, is House File 3031, which is my bill, so Representative Benson is going to take the gavel.
Thank you.
Very important. Right. No, it is
Madam Chair, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. So I would move House File 3031, and is it going to the General Register?
It says here, Committee on Health and Human Services, Finance.
Okay, so it would move to, that sounds about right, of course, Health and Human Services, Finance. And then, Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment also.
Yes,
I'd like
would you like to move that? Would you like to move that now?
Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Liebley moves the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape to which you would like it to be discussed. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right, if you proceed.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. So, members, this is an important bill that I would actually say is really a great unsession bill, because what it attempts to do is unscramble and very much simplify some of our public program administration. Because as you're going to find out, and I'm sure many of you know, a lot of our public programs have very confusing, different requirements, like different asset limits that participants can have, different income limits. And figuring that out, I think the committee members here know, figuring that out is just a huge challenge for the financial workers who do the eligibility for these programs. And so I'm going to turn this over to my testifiers to actually explain what we're trying to do to simplify these programs. But I think that for people who like government to just work and work smoothly, this is a very important piece, and it's been worked on for quite a while by counties and by DHS, and it's something that I really hope that we can move forward with this year. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to committee. If you identify yourself for the record, and proceed, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee, and I'd like to say thank you also to Representative Liebling. I'm Tony Carter from Ramsey County. I'm a commissioner there, and I'm also this year's president of the Association of Minnesota Counties. I have been serving for a number of years on the Human Services Performance and Outcomes Reform Committee, along with Judith Brumfield from Scott County Community Human Services Director, who is here to testify with me today. And Judith Brumfield is also co-chair of the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. We're representing then all 87 of Minnesota's counties and speaking in support of Senate File 2658. Human Services administrative simplification is critical to building a more sustainable human services system, and as such, one of AMC's top legislative priorities is that simplification this session. In keeping, as we've heard, with the governor's unsession agenda, this proposal provides support and real substantive change that will benefit our state and our counties and all of the participants across our human services system. Simplification of our systems is critical at this point for the following reasons. It will better assure that our customer service is enhanced and enhance client outcomes. It is an essential step in the advance of human services technology systems modernization, and it will also provide administrative cost avoidance, improve our error rates, and enhance program integrity. the legislative auditor and the OLA 2007 report provided some context as to why this is so important. The OLA study found that Minnesota's human services system is overly complex with many eligibility rules that are too complex, in fact, to automate. Moreover, since 1985, the amount of human services-related statutes has more than tripled, and state administrative rules have more than doubled. 7 years later, in 2014, we've yet to make significant progress on this issue. The result is a complicated system of eligibility requirements that is challenging for counties to administer, confusing for our participants, and many of those, of course, are in crisis and unable to navigate the system to their better outcome. The changes that are contained in this bill would provide uniformity and simplification across the MFIP, Minnesota Family Investment Program, GA, General Assistance, MSA, Minnesota Supplemental Assistance, and GRH, Group Residential Housing Programs. Some of the bill's key aspects are simplifying and aligning how assets are treated across all our programs, simplifying the determination of self-employment income, and standardizing earned income disregards. So again, counties do believe that these changes are not only critical for enhancing administration of the programs, but also and fundamentally in providing better outcomes for all of the people that we serve. In closing, we ask your support of the bill, which is a significant step toward a more sustainable and modern system for our human services across the board. And I'll now ask Judith Brumfield to provide more detail about the legislation. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Judith Brumfield. I'm the Health and Human Services Director for Scott County. I'm representing today the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA. Just wanted to very briefly go through the contents of the bill for you so you fully understand what it is we're asking for. And as Ms. Carter stated, this really does simplify four of the major programs or income support programs that are state-supervised county-administered programs. This bill came as a result of concentrated work on the department on the part of Department of Human Services and the counties together, really to look at the complication of our programs and to talk about how we might simplify those. The goals of the bill, again, are really to simplify four income support programs. At the same time, it's very important to us that we maintain program integrity, and we believe that this bill does it as well, and it simplifies the statutes both for our clients and for our staff. An example, I didn't have to carry it here today, but this is the policy manual that our staff need to use. This is double-sided, I believe 10-point font. This is how they have to do their job. It takes a minimum of 18 months for us to train staff in order to do this kind of work. What you have today, and the reason it looks like such a large bill, is that there are actually four statutes. They are now being, in terms of these points, being condensed into one statute. Part of the complication of this is that each time a legislative change was made to one of the programs, it made it out of alignment with the other programs. So what we're really trying to do is in those areas align all four programs so that our workers only have to deal with one set of requirements. It also obviously will make it much easier for the people we serve because many times they're on more than one program and what they have to declare for income on one program is very different than what they have to declare for income on another program. So we're looking at an alignment of assets. Instead of having 10 categories for four different programs, we would get down to really two major categories. Do they have cash, bank accounts, or vehicles? And you look at a single asset determination for them instead of multiple asset determinations. Earned income disregard. This is a major one. Each of our programs have a different amount of income you can earn. What this bill proposes is to align them all with the SSI, which is a federal program we can't change. so that the people are able to earn $65 plus 50% of anything beyond that. So to give you an example of one program, our group residential housing program has virtually no income at all that they can earn. This is a program that's often used by people who have chronic chemical dependency issues or mental illness. They've gone through treatment and now they're in a group residential housing arrangement. They can never get out of it, because they're never able to earn enough money for their damage deposit and first month's rent. So by allowing them to earn that amount of money, we can move them actually off of the program. 30-day reinstatements. We have many clients who come through our program who, because of the complication of the forms and the paperwork they need to do, don't get their redetermination in on time. If it's more than 30 days, then they have to be totally closed off the program and reapplied. That's a lot of work for our staff to do, and obviously a lot of frustration for our clients, and a major loss if they have no benefits during that time period. So we're asking for a 30-day period in which they could be reopened if they get their paperwork in without having to totally redo all the paperwork for it. And finally, we're looking at simplifying self-employment income. I simply tried to read what self-employment income was and the number of exceptions and exemptions. I couldn't understand it. And yet we expect our clientele, many of whom don't even have a high school education, to understand what they can and cannot have and what they need to report. So what it ends up for us at the county level is a lot of errors. And errors get penalized, and the state as a whole can be held financially accountable for that and have to pay penalties. It also means that we have a number of overpayments, so our system is not as efficient as it should be. Consequently, we think it's really important to simplify, and that's really what this bill does. But another major reason that we feel like this really has to pass this year is that this legislature last year allocated a fairly substantial sum of money to upgrading our systems. Our systems are going to have a lot of difficulty being upgraded if we have to build in all of these requirements. So it will end up actually costing us far more to build a system with all these requirements than to simplify our system first and then upgrade. We believe, again, this is something that the Department of Human Services helped us work on and believes it's important, and the counties are bringing it forward, hoping that you will support it this session. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for this work. This is my neighbor works for Rice County Welfare for many, many years. I hear about the amount of work, double that she has to take care of, and then cross-reference and, you know, for every program known to man. For many, many years, and I hear from the workers themselves who wish that this could have been done years ago, and it just, you know, it got beyond us. It got beyond us with all the programs and the cross-references and, you know, for MPIP and for all of those programs. And as a legislator, serving here, I had some knowledge of what even the acronyms were, but there's so many. And then, you get into the guts of the area and trying to help our constituents who need these programs, and then to find them losing a program or losing money or losing housing or losing health care because they didn't get in time. And this goes on in Rice County. This goes on in southern Minnesota as well as in your area in Ramsey County too. So I thank you very much for taking this on. This is a lot of work and long overdue.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to echo that. I want to thank you. This is something I hear about, too. I recall a day I was knocking doors in a neighborhood in St. Peter, and I ran across a county worker who actually worked in Blue Earth County, and this is what she said. And I worked years ago with the Minnesota Valley Action Council, and so we interfaced a lot with the county social services, and the complexity of it was at times overwhelming. I I thought particularly I saw combining four into one statute, so the programs are aligned, linking the some of the determinations to SSI, which is kind of a really pegged target. That's just good, solid work. My compliments. Your presentation, Ms. Brumfield, I thought was one of the best presentations I've heard. I do have a couple of questions. One is you mentioned that it takes 18 months to train on those books. Good. That's pretty efficient training, it looks like. But my question is, how will the changes be communicated to the county workers and to the citizens?
Ms. Brumfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there are a couple of ways. This manual is actually also electronic, so I purchased three screens for my staff doing this work, so they have one for their Maxis, one for this, one for their other programs. But it will be electronic, and all of the information will now be in one place and much simpler. But if you simply read the statute, it's understandable now, and they are bright. They will have no trouble at all, for the most part, remembering it, and they can always look it up if they need it. The communication with clients, every time we meet with them, we're telling them what they need to do. My impression, because I get the calls when they're unhappy, is they usually don't understand. I think it would be much simpler to say, I need to know how much you have in savings, in cash, and in your bank account, than to go through 20 different things and ask them to report that as well. So the communication will be directly from the staff working with the clients. We believe by simplifying this, they will have more time to actually make sure people understand what they need to turn in.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question, but before that, I just want to comment that, you know, my hair was a different color back when I worked at Minnesota Valley Action Council, and I think there's been multiple administrations on representing multiple political parties, three political parties, that really haven't been able to effectively tackle this. And based on your testimony, I'm hopeful that we can pull this off. And my compliment to everybody involved, including the governor, for pushing the unsession. I am a personal fan of the unsession, and today is a reason I am. My follow-up question, though, is how long do you think it will take to effectively implement the change? Will it be automatic, or are you seeing a phase in time, or how will that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, if you look in the bill, there are a number of different dates for implementation, and that really is because the state is having to reprogram some of their systems in order to do this. So what we came forward with are the 2014 recommendations that will go into effect really during this fiscal year, or this and the next fiscal year. But each of them have a slightly different date, depending upon how soon they can program the system to make those changes. We also are putting forward some things that get us into the position to make some changes as we move into the next session as well.
Representative Johnson. Representative Abler.
Oh, thanks. And this has been a project that's been banged around for a while, and get almost that many notes on the project, I think, in the
yes, we do.
Binder. So a couple questions. How thick would that book be after you got done? Would it be half as big, or what do you think?
Ms. Broomfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abel, I don't know, but I'm looking at something about this size.
All right.
Representative Abler.
Yeah, and part of the trouble is that you have to pay money to change this, and there's people that get added in. And so can you just give me an example of what GRH would look like, what the eligibility changes would be on that, if you offhand? I just have a special interest in a project about that.
Ms. Broomfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I'm not sure I can totally answer your question. My understanding is the eligibility would not change. What will change in this is primarily the earned income disregard, so that people on GRH will be able to retain some of their earnings in order really to be able to move off the program. The other thing is the assets would be different. They would be able to have more money up front that they could hold in savings.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I think that, so just to and that's the whole discussion itself. And I think right now if you make a dollar over the amount, then you lose everything. And if you keep a dollar under, you get it all. So it's a very interesting cliff that they have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure this carries a cost. And can And so what you've done is, have you established two different tiers of assets and income instead of all the rest? Is that, that'd be a question.
Ms. Broomfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abel, I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, well, this time, well, you have to combine asset standards and usually have to put them at the upper level compared to going to where the lowest one was. And so a GRH person could retain some assets where they would have lost them because you're making them all the same. So that's just, I'll leave it as a statement. But how many more people would qualify for programs, do you think, that are currently not qualifying for programs because of this? Like 5% more or 10% more, something like that?
Ms. Broomfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I really don't know the answer to that. There is a fiscal note to this. We also actually did a county fiscal note to look at our savings, and they are fairly closely matched, but there is a fiscal note to this.
All right. Is this going to go to the Finance Committee? Okay, well, we can. But so actually, Mr. Chair, just to help with all of our budgeting, if the counties save the money, then they could pay for this bill. They always give me that look, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Not to help.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to first just thank Representative Liebling for bringing this bill forward, but also for the partnership that we have with Ms. Brumfield and Commissioner Carter for just looking at how we can really streamline the work that you do at the county and how we here at the state can help make that possible. I'm kind of like in the opposition of listening to Representative Abler in his question about how many more will become eligible by this bill and looking at how many more people will be able to lift themselves out of poverty and get out of the system, so by allowing them to become more self-sufficient through this process. But, you know, I think in my opinion, streamlining is what is needed. It's more, I mean, to be more efficient, to be more, you know, clear and simple about what the requirement is just, to me, moving in the right direction. So again, I just really would like to thank, the county for coming to the state to see how we can begin breaking down those statutes that has been compounded by one over one to a place where it has just become really cumbersome.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and just to the point that Representative Abler brought up, I actually think, and I really am glad that we're finally moving forward, because I think these ideas have been kicking around for more than a decade, some of them. But I think actually what it does is it doesn't make so many more people eligible, it just makes it possible for them to get through the paper blizzard to establish their eligibility. And if you have a person with a disability who doesn't value all the pieces of paper that we all get, and they throw out their savings account statement that shows that they have $10.57. Right now, that is a huge barrier for their renewing their eligibility, even though everyone knows they are totally eligible. There's no, I mean, even if they won a bought a lottery ticket and won it, that is reported to the county. So, you know, everybody knows they're eligible, but you have to go through all kinds of hoops, involve their case manager, maybe someone who's at their group home or their employment, trying to get the bank to send a duplicate statement so you can prove that this person with a disability has less than $15 in their bank account. But their whole access to their care, to their medicines, everything else is disrupted because of that. This just puts some common sense, I think, into some of the processes that we use. And I think it's going to make it more possible for us to recruit and retain employees in the future, because the computer systems and the rules are just not something that most people have much patience with. I think they're much, much more complicated than some of the most complicated parts of our tax system.
Okay, Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your work on this, too. I've had lots of complaints in the last few years from my social workers. Yeah, but one of the things they complain about, too, is that technology is so far outdated. Does this do it? I stepped out of the room for a minute. I apologize. Does this do anything to address the technology? My understanding, if I remember from last session, it was like $30 million to upgrade the technology, which if we got rid of MNsure, we'd have plenty of money to do that. Just a thought. Okay.
Ms. Grunfeld or Commissioner Carter?
Well, I might just start out by saying that one of the things that the legislative auditor commented on was that we have so many differences and so many different levels and different areas of programs that it is difficult to automate. And, of course, our county workers are working with systems that are antiquated right now and look forward to that automation. This would help us to get there, uniformity and simplicity as such. And if I might turn it over to Judith to continue that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, you're correct. Last year's legislative session did authorize money for systems modernization, and that is in the works. By doing this, we will make it more possible to do that system modernization within the budget that's set for it. And part of the dates on this and the things that are being set up for 2015 and beyond are so that we can implement simplification as we move into the systems modernization. Oh, okay. So they go together.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. But, you know, open house or something like that. I can't remember the term they used. But I think Representative Mack was a part of it, where there was a Wisconsin model of upgraded technology that we could automatically adopt at a very reasonable cost, if I remember right. And I don't know if that's in the works or not, but just if you've got any information on that, or are we taking some from another state or getting a federal grant?
Ms. Broomfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, we will be getting federal match money to help with this. One of the problems is we can't use any off-the-shelf system at this point because of this. If we get rid of this, we have the option to do that, which will be far less expensive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, with this streamlining and making the process maybe a little bit more simpler for the caseworkers, the news that came up over the weekend about that couple that was living in Florida on the million-dollar yacht there, taking away much-needed funding away from those that desperately needed the help here in Minnesota, would your new process, would that make it easier to catch those who are gaming the system, per se?
Ms. Broomfield.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, I would like to say we can catch people like that all the time. The reality is there are a lot of ways that people could game the system. We take it very seriously. Part of what the state has actually done is to look at needing to evaluate those things differently. So they've upgraded the Inspector General's office. We have more fraud prevention officers in the county. I think this would make it easier sometimes to catch some of the things, but it's more likely to catch those who are inadvertently ineligible because they didn't declare something because they didn't understand they needed to. A very sophisticated person who could pull off something like that is probably fairly hard to catch. It looks like they did it in about 3 states, so it's not only Minnesota that didn't catch them initially.
Representative Franzen? Representative Mack?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question for the testifiers and then maybe a question for the author. But I think it's good for members to realize this bill, if I'm understanding correctly, addresses 4 of our programs, MSA, MFIP, GA, and GRH. Out of how many programs? This is 4 out of how many public programs?
Ms. Broomfield.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
2 bills will do the same thing.
I'm not sure exactly how many programs. These 4 make up actually less than 20% of the time that our staff spend. The 2 major programs that are not addressed by this are the food support program and the medical support program. The medical support program is actually being simplified at this point in time. Complicated now, but it is being, the program itself is being simplified and using many of these same things. Many of these characteristics are currently present in the food support program as well. We'd be looking at those long term, but these are the more complicated 4, even though they're less than half of what we do.
Okay.
Representative Mack.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was one thing I know I'd met with folks who represent the counties a couple weeks ago, and I just had to ask them to refresh my memory. But I do think they had pointed out that this will result in 30% savings in staff time at the county level, and these, and that kind of dovetails with the fact that, like you said, these four programs account for 17%, is what they said, of staff time. So, I mean, it's a good amount. It's a significant amount. I think that this is a huge step in the right direction, and there's opportunity for more of this. I know this is a long time coming, and it's not easy, and I'm grateful to the work of the counties who I know have carried a lot of the water on this. It's disappointing that the governor didn't include this in his original budget, and so I'm hoping that, you know, we as the committee and the chairs can get this through the process into the governor's office, even though he didn't have it in his budget. But my one question to the author is just in section 37, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, in there it talks about the commissioner reporting back to the legislature, putting together prospective budgeting for some of these, and right now it's a permissive may, and I'm just wondering why the may versus the shall in terms of coming back to the legislature, if there maybe be an appetite. Just I just think kind of the legislature knowing about changes in the eligibility and what's going on in these programs would maybe be a good move, but maybe you were strategic in why you left the permissive language on that.
Representative Lievely.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mack, and, you know, as so often with this kind of legislation, I didn't draft it, but I think that the point there is that this is about coming back with a plan for implementation and legislation, may prepare legislation. So I think it kind of says, what I read it as saying, if it's necessary to have some. If you say must, then you're saying we're going to have legislation whether we need it or not. At least that's how I would kind of read it on the fly here. But maybe my testifiers have another comment on that and whether that should really be may or must. It's certainly good talk about.
Representative, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Larry Hosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Section 37 of the bill came from a work group process that was conducted between the counties and the department and other interested stakeholders in these programs. This is the project was a multi-year approach, and what you're seeing today is 2014 recommendations, but that work group also had 2015 recommendations and other recommendations that would be dependent on systems modernization when that was implemented. And they wanted to have some assurances in this bill that work could continue to move forward, and it didn't want to be so prescriptive in which it might constitute a fiscal note or additional cost, but allow the work of that group to continue to move forward in providing legislation and recommendations for further uniformity and simplification.
President Mack. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Abley.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I didn't mean to sound negative when I was asking my questions. I just want to have people know what they're buying. And it's always a series of choices you have to make here. And like in the GRH program, it seems madness to have if you're $1 over that you're just suddenly cast out. And I think a lot of us want these programs to be places that people transition through onto the way to a destination that doesn't include being in these programs for their time. You know, the better we design that, the more we're friendly in our discussions about that, the more we can, on a bipartisan basis, get the benefit that we all think is to be had out of here. Ironically, Health Match, I think we spent 20-something million on that. The second year fiscal note of this is half of that. But it's good to have a good discussion. I just want to remind members that that we have a $75 million target in the finance side of this committee. The tails that we have are $581 million, which are going to be paid for in perpetuity. And so if this costs $10 or $12 million in the next biennium, you just want to know that you're spending the money and that the people come after us can't buy something else. And so we just want to make sure that we know what things cost and what we're getting. And there's a room full of people here last time that were hoping to buy something else with the money than we did in the targets that we had. And maybe somebody cares about a particular health-related clinic that might get some money, or another disparity group, or something else. And so But the best we have a good, robust discussion, the better we can make sure that we're getting the best value and that we can capture savings and put them into something that we like. So I commend the workers on this thing. We've been talking about this my whole time here, and so I hope that you can find some way to put some sense into this. And frankly, somebody mentioned turnover in the staff. You want to have good staff who know the families, who can focus on the family and not on that book, and actually see how their interactions are going and what's the interaction in the family, and is, you know, and because that helps as much as anything. So good luck. Thanks.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I have a couple of questions that would pertain to documenting, verifying, and recertifying, which is found on page 24. The first of my questions is, I'm just wondering if we're creating a dichotomy of a purpose here.
And excuse me, Mr. Chair, what page? Or we didn't
24.
Thank you.
Because on lines 24.16 and 17, it says that the participant or applicant, the agency shall assist the applicant or participant in obtaining verifications and required documents when the applicant or participant is unable to do so. But then on line 24.20, it says the applicant or participant has the burden of providing documentary evidence to verify eligibility. It's unclear to me who's responsible for applying for the program and who's going to assist, and who are we enabling, or what are we doing here?
Whichever testifier would like to respond.
Yes.
Bloomfield?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albrecht, this means actually a couple of things. Our staff have responsibility to help people verify where we can do so. Many times there are electronic systems that we can use to get verification, for example, of birth certificates, those kinds of things. So the first portion you read does make us responsible to assist when we can to do those kind of things. But it does not relieve the burden of the applicant to provide verification when they need to do that. So, for example, we could have them provide their bank statement to show how much they had in savings. So the responsibility remains with the applicants, but the responsibility for the county staff are to assist in that verification whenever possible. And I'm wondering if you had a different response.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Albright, if you take a look at the repealer section, 256J.32 and several subdivisions are repealed. The new underlying language in the new chapter of statute is based or predicated on this repealed language. So it's existing practice in the continuing verification and documentation that we currently have. But instead of being in four, you know, for four different programs, four different slight variations, we based it on this repealed language. So this is existing practice for MPIP right now.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a little bit further down for the testifiers or for the author, whomever might choose to answer, on line 24.22, it says, and I'll read from just preceding to that, the agency must accept a signed personal statement from the applicant or participant when determining personal property values. And I don't have 256, the statute, in front of me, but I'm wondering if someone could elaborate in terms of, it seems that there's great latitude that would be inferred by that statement in terms of when determining personal property values. I'm wondering if that we could be a little more explicit or elaborative in terms of what that means.
Is Broomfield or Rosh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. This area would allow for a signed personal statement to count as verification when determining the assets for a household or a participant. And right now we're counting two categories of assets under this proposal. One is cash and bank accounts. The second is liquid stocks and bonds that can be accessed without a penalty. If there is, under this would also be a statement of a warning for penalty of perjury or fraud. That's in our existing combined application form. We would be repeating that disclaimer. And then if there is inconsistent information known to the agency or known to the county, then the county can then require additional verifications besides that signed statement.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question, and this would be on the following page, on page 25, and it has to do with the certification of Social Security numbers. And I just draw your attention to line 25.8, where it says cooperates with the procedures for verification of Social Security numbers. What exactly does that mean?
Bloomfield?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Albrecht, in most cases, the person comes in with a Social Security number. There are times when they have lost it, and they have to show that they have reapplied for a Social Security number. That could take a lengthy period of time to get it back. If we can verify that they do indeed have a Social Security number, we just have to get the verification from the Social Security Administration. So it allows us to proceed if we have good cause to believe that, yes, indeed, they have it, and we are assisting them in getting, actually, the card with the verification number.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to put it that in practical terms, I present myself, and I have the number memorized, but I don't have a written or a paper copy of the Social Security number, and in order to authenticate the application, you need that.
Ms. Broomfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I believe, and it's been a while since I looked at it, that we actually have to have a copy of the Social Security card in the record. But in the cases where, and you know, sometimes we have very elderly people who have lost it, if we have enough verification that they indeed do have one, while they're getting the new card, we can go ahead with that.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright. If you look at the beginning of this paragraph, this is an exception for qualified non-citizens who are victims of domestic violence. And qualified non-citizens, for example, is somebody who is lawfully admitted for permanent residence into the United States or admitted into the United States as a refugee according to the United States Code. So if you have a person who's a victim of domestic violence, might not have that Social Security card, this gives... This allows for that provision of the Social Security number to be waived. And that's for the protection of the participant and also the realities that sometimes a qualified individual might not have a Social Security card right at their disposal.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to your point on the victims of domestic violence or qualified non-citizens, would you also then accept they would be in the process of applying for a Social Security number, but they would have another form of identification that would also be applicable?
Mr. Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. They would still have to comply with all the other nine provisions, as you can see, under the subdivision. So identity of adults, age, immigration status, income, everything except for the one item, the item 10.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Comments? I would renew my motion that House File 3031, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed?
Thank you. Okay, members, the next bill is House File 3216, Representative Huntley. And Representative Huntley is going to move that House File 3216 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And then Representative Huntley has an A1 author's amendment. And did you want to move that, Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair, the A1 amendment is really very technical, and it's just clarifying some language and does not really change the intent of anything in the bill.
Okay, so Representative Huntley is going to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order in which he'd like to have it discussed. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And Representative Huntley, please present your bill.
Madam Chair, members, this is the Governor's Health and Human Service Omnibus Finance Bill, written by the Governor, so there will obviously be some changes in it. And we have people here from the two departments to testify on the bill and explain what's in the Governor's bill. So I'd ask them to come down, and I think the Health Department is first, if I remember right.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Just while they're coming, is this the bill that you have as your delete-all, kind of, or is it?
This is not my delete-all. This is strictly.
No, I understand, but isn't a lot of this stuff in your delete-all already, or?
Representative Huntley.
Much of it is the same.
Yeah.
But we have added things to and deleted things in the bill that you're going to see on or saw this morning.
Yeah.
And by the way, this bill is in this committee. There's a clone of it that was in civil law this morning and got sent to judiciary. And we may have a problem with early childhood as well, but that's something I'll deal with in the finance committee.
Okay.
Fine.
All right. So... Representative Abler, the parts are
going
different places, and hopefully they'll all come together in the Finance Committee when Representative Huntley updates his bill. And so my understanding is that whatever, for example, we might amend in this committee then goes to his committee, and he would incorporate it into his bill unless the... unless that committee decides to do something different with it.
Madam Chair, just whatever some people on our side think, I love clone bills. It's so handy. You can just go to multiple places all the same day, and your witnesses just come to town one day, and they can. But I was just going to suggest, if just for instance, time and interest, if there's some things that we've done a lot of work in this committee and in the Finance Committee on some of this stuff, and I don't need to hear it all again unless there's something you want to add as a highlight. Maybe something that would be interesting to hear what Senate Representative didn't put in the bill that you would have wanted. That'd be kind of fun. I'll rest, Madam Chair.
That would be all the right. Human Services Department.
All right. So starting with Mr. Greenman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. I think most of you have heard about our Article 1 already. This is the governor's proposal to create an integrated system for providing oversight for providers who deliver both home care services licensed by the health department and home and community-based services licensed by DHS. These are two different types of services. They have different levels of care, different types of services, and are subject to different regulations. There are about 200 providers in the state who deliver both types of services, and without a change in the law, they would be subject to being licensed by both agencies having two separate licenses. What this Article 1 basically does is establishes an integrated licensing system for these two types of providers. It allows a provider, if you look at Article 1, it allows Subdivision 2 creates a system where providers who are licensed as home care providers can be designated to deliver home and community-based services. This would both the designation and the license would come through the health department. So this would allow them to work with just one agency. These providers who are designated as home and community-based services would have to meet additional requirements that relate to delivering home and community-based services, and they would be subject to monitoring and enforcement of those additional regulations by the health department. There is a fee involved for the designation, and then also a renewal fee. However, this is significantly less expensive than getting a license to do home and community-based services. So that's essentially Article 1. This came from a recommendation or a request from the legislature last year to have the agencies look at an integrated system, and this is a result of that.
All right. Members, are there any questions relating to Article 1 that Mr. Greenman just described? All right. Not seeing any, so I think we could move on. Mr. Greenman, are you going to, is somebody else going to describe the other articles, or are you continuing here?
Madam Chair, the rest, I think, belong to DHS, so I'll
okay.
Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Mack?
Yeah, just a quick question, maybe to the department. I don't know if you can answer to Article 1 or not, but just as we go forward, maybe to DHS, if you could just explain, because it is a confusing process. I was in finance this morning, and it's moving. If you could just explain maybe what pieces of this are in the clone bill that we heard this morning and the other places that it's at, so we just get a handle. I'm trying to figure out what, if we're hearing anything brand new that I haven't heard in finance yet or haven't heard somewhere else. So just clarification on the moving parts, we can just get a handle on how this is all coming together and where the various parts are in addition to this committee today, maybe.
Madam Chair, this proposal was included in and Representative Huntley's delete all amendment this morning.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Max. It's an excellent suggestion. If we could follow through with that as we go through here, that'd be very helpful to all of us. So next up, I think, is Julie Marquardt. There she is. And Sandy Berg?
Berg, yes.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Burge, and I'm the manager of the benefit recovery area for third-party liability at the department. And the governor is proposing that we participate in a coordination of benefits registry that's being built by a nonprofit, the Council of Affordable and Quality Healthcare. And the purpose of this is to try and solve a problem that exists right now in the billing system, where as a provider, you don't know from the outset who the proper party is to bill. So what this registry will provide free of charge to providers and to clearinghouses, so if you work with a clearinghouse, it'll come through to your billing department, and it will tell you not only who the overlapping coverages are, but what the primacy is, who you should bill first, who you should bill second, who the payer of last resort is. And so it is something we think will be of benefit to providers and to patients. Representative Huntley last night talked about a personal experience he has where for patients, you can be sitting there not knowing if your bill is paid or not for multiple months. So we recommend that the funding be provided for this. There is a small savings attached to this that would pay for the contract costs.
Okay, questions for members on this piece? And Ms. Burge, first of all, could you just pull the mic just a tiny bit closer? Thank you. And then maybe you could answer Representative Mack's previous question as to this. Have we heard this in other, is this part of Representative Huntley's delete all amendment? Has
yes.
it been in other committees?
Yes, it was attached to the delete all amendment this morning, and it was heard in Health and Human Services Finance last night as an informational piece.
Okay, and Ms. Burge, has this been to civil law or judiciary or anything like that? Or because I'm just wondering if what you're describing having, I'm not sure it needs to go there, but just kind of wondering because what you're describing has to do with insurance and liability and data exchange, and
it was our understanding that it did not need to go to those committees.
Well,
Madam Chair,
okay. The clone has, Madam Chair, the clone has been to was in civil law this morning. It got sent to judiciary, and when it comes back, I'm not sure. But it's the basically it's exactly the same language that's in this bill, not the delete all that we did this.
Okay.
This is the third time I've done this bill today.
Okay. And Representative Huntley, now that you say that, of course, I sit on civil law, and so I heard it first thing this morning. Gosh, could that be this morning? It seems like a week ago already. But I do recall that, but the whole conversation focused on a different article, in which, but of course, all this language was there. So if they don't talk about it, I guess shame on them. Right? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when we refer to a clone bill, is that a clone bill of the governor's bill, or is the clone bill a clone of your Representative Huntley's delete all?
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Representative, is the governor's bill. Okay, and this is the governor's bill, what you have before you right now.
Okay.
We started this in my committee with this bill, but we then did a delete all, turned it into what's my bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Marquardt, did you want to add something additional on this article, on Article 2?
Yes.
Okay, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Julie Marquardt. I'm the Director of Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS, and I'm just going to quickly cover the remaining sections of Article 2. What the remaining sections do are modify payments to inpatient services for hospitals. And then there is one section that deals with supplemental payments we make to federally qualified health centers. And so it's probably simplest for me to talk about Section 21st, which is the FQHC component. There's language that we had originally proposed to try to simplify and shorten the period of time that it takes for us to do the settle-ups on managed care claims from the federally qualified health centers. We are in the process right now of finalizing alternative language with the FQHCs that we actually think will improve not just the timeline, but even the process itself, making the payments more timely. So we hope to have that completed and actually bring forward something even better than what we had hoped. So, but that's the intent of that, is to improve the timeliness and the accuracy of those payments. The remaining sections all deal with inpatient hospital services, and I know many people have probably already heard how this works, but I will try to do it briefly so that people understand who maybe haven't heard what it is we are trying to accomplish. First and foremost, it will allow us to comply with the federal requirement on October 1st of 2014 that all payers and providers must use ICD-10 coding. We are currently using ICD-9 coding. The department does not currently have the necessary piece of software, nor do we have authority to use a piece of software that will read the ICD-10 codes from an inpatient hospital claim. And that piece of software is called a grouper, and that groups the information from the claim to identify it within a type of admission, if you want to think of it very loosely, is it recognizes it as, oh, this is a claim for a birth, or this is a claim for an appendectomy, or this is a claim for a heart surgery. And so it helps payers group those claims and then assign rates to those. We currently don't have a grouper that would read the 10 claims. This would allow us to do that and appropriately group those claims. As a result of changing your grouper, particularly one that is moving from version 23, which we are on, to a version 31, we have to reset the rates. We can't just drop old rates into a new grouper when the DRGs, which is the resulting grouper, they are all different. They are all going to change. And so we have to set new rates for all of those things. In the process of that, our current rates are based on 2002 costs from hospitals, which I think we and probably every hospital would agree that there's no relationship between 2002 costs and what it costs them to do services today. So as part of this, when we reset those new rates, we will also base them on 2012 costs. So we will update the costs for hospitals. This will not affect, I should make this clear, it will not affect our long-term care hospitals.
or our rehab hospitals or rehab distinct units in hospitals. Those are paid on a different methodology. We will also treat critical access hospitals differently. We will try to move them to a more Medicare-like cost-based rate methodology that should stabilize and make more predictable their payments and not be so subject to volume. If they see less cases, that shouldn't be quite as dramatic a change for them. It also requires we will change the grouper from the CMS version, which we use now, to what's called the APR-DRG grouper. The APR-DRG grouper does a better job of of identifying all of the Medicaid services, births, neonatal, that will all get incorporated. And then finally, it makes changes to requirements for hospitals to report their disproportionate share audit reports. We will be required by federal law to be auditing hospitals who claim disproportionate share payments, and so this will prepare us to comply with that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Markbart. I do have a question, and I see Representative Loeffler. Why don't we let Representative Loeffler go first? Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Markbart. On page 15 in section 14, there's a provision related to hospital residents. And we have, in Representative Huntley's area, looked at the whole issue of our healthcare workforce shortage. And I'm not seeing how this will help us, if I'm understanding it correctly, because it sounds like in the future it will be based on a rate computed by multiplying the statewide average cost to charge ratio by the usual and customary charges. And I have always heard from the teaching hospitals that it is expensive to have a resident because, you know, you have to kind of go through procedures twice, or you have to, the supervising physician has to, you know, chat with the training physician who's a resident about what they're going to do and how did it work out, and they may or may not be always grabbing the best piece of sterile tools to use, and then they have to grab something else, and, you know, that sort of thing. And so that there's a cost to having a resident as well as a value to all of us. But I don't see that if it's based on a statewide average rate, that really picks up that extra cost of supervising someone in training. And so can you explain to me what your thought was about this part of it? I understand all those other things, but I'm not sure if I understand what this does for medical residency training.
Right, and before you answer that, Ms. Marquardt, and I just want to let members know we're on Article 2. We've got 20 minutes to finish the bill, and there are 5 articles in it. So I think we need to at least give them all a glance. So, Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, I think it will help to understand that in this hospital, residents means patients who are residents of the hospital. So it's payment for people whose stay goes beyond 180 days, and then it's the rate we will pay to the hospital. So it will have no impact on...
Oh, well, thank you. I just see hospital and
president,
Madam Chair. Right. And I will just say, Madam Chair, this bill was introduced on the 19th. It has some real policy implications, and so I think we actually should know.
But no, absolutely, Representative Loeffler. Thank you for the question. I actually had the same confusion when I was reading it, and I kind of knew that was going to be your answer, but absolutely. And I wonder, you know, that does bring up the question of whether we need any clarifying language, or is it in context, is it clear that that's what you mean, do you think?
Because we Madam don't maybe Chair, get the I context. Think that Mark Warren. We are actually, I meant to say this and I haven't said this yet, we are actually working closely with the Hospital Association, with hospitals who are giving us feedback on improving and clarifying language. So I will note that. That one hadn't come up, but I will note it because we will be doing a good deal of changes to help specify and clarify what's
okay,
going
thank
on.
You. And my question is Section 16 of this article. Okay. Which is on page 18 of the bill, and it's separate billing by certified registered nurse anesthetist. Can you just kind of give me a real quick explanation of why you're doing that?
Madam Chair, we are today we allow a hospital to choose whether to include or exclude those costs into the costs that they report to us. This is going to clarify and standardize that, as everyone will exclude. It doesn't impact payments made to CRNAs. They're paid separate. It's just whether or not the hospital includes those costs in their cost reporting to us. And we had some doing it and some that didn't, and this will standardize that.
Okay. Other questions for members? All right, seeing none, let's move on to Article 3. And I know we've had some discussion about this. This is where the Civil Law Committee was working, worked it over this morning, I would say, worked it over pretty well. But maybe we can just have a brief explanation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Sellen. I'm an area manager in Hennepin County at the Department of Human Services. I'm project lead for North Star Care for Children. Madam Chair, you referenced the discussion at Civil Law this morning. You'll be pleased to know that we've been discussing with the stakeholders. We think we're very close to an agreement on amendment that should handle at least much of the concerns that were raised at that point. The Article 3 makes technical changes to North Star Care for Children. They're primarily bringing North Star Care for Children and statute into federal compliance. You may remember that North Star Care for Children unifies benefits for foster care, relative care, and adoptions. And in order to eliminate barriers for children acquiring permanent families, we make extensive use of federal Title IV funds in accomplishing that. And so, for example, it adds federally required background studies. These are the same that are in current practice in foster care. They're new to kinship assistance, and we'll be cleaning up some of the language in judiciary tomorrow around kinship, around the transfer of legal custody. It also brings into federal compliance the eligibility for kinship guardianship assistance, that the prospective relative custodian must be a licensed foster parent for 6 consecutive months, and an optional transition from kinship assistance to adoption assistance. Adoption is the federal preferred option, and so there has to be a door open to that for anyone whose custody has been transferred.
And Mr. Sellen, excuse me, I don't think you introduced yourself, and I'm so used to seeing you today that I didn't ask you to do it before. But I think you need to say your name into the tape and make sure members know who you are.
Certainly, Madam Chair. I think I may have, but my name is John Sellen. I'm an area manager in Hennepin County, and I'm working currently at the Department of Human Services as the project lead for North Star Care for Children.
All right, thank you. Sorry if I asked you to do that twice.
No problem, Madam Chair. And then, Madam Chair and members, continuing, it eliminates an unneeded at-risk status for kinship guardianship assistance and an unneeded special at-risk payment for adoption assistance. These provisions were not federal requirements as we had originally understood them. It adds federal requirements to court proceedings for transfer of physical and legal custody, defining the required court findings, permitting the court to defer finalization, and adding documentation required of the agency to the out-of-home placement plan for court review. And then there are a variety of provisions for streamlining processes, reducing duplications, adding legal references, and language inclusive of tribal practice. For instance, it eliminates the background studies at the time of adoption or transfer of legal custody if those background studies have already been performed at the point when the prospective caregiver was being licensed as a foster parent. And these occur in sections 3, 4, 11, 14, and 24. It clarifies eligibility to be inclusive of tribal, county agency, and court practices, changes the name of the component from guardianship assistance to kinship assistance. We found the term guardianship was confusing for people since it's actually a benefit for children whose custody has been transferred to a relative custodian. And finally, it adds various cross-references and streamlining and clarifying in a variety of sections.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Sellen. Are there questions for members? Representative Albright.
Thank you. And to the testifier, and this is on page 33, starting at line 33.9. And this is not to sound trite, but That section, to me, only makes sense. Why was it added? I'm trying to understand why it wasn't included before.
Mr. Stellan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it was simply a mistake on our part why it wasn't included before. This is a federal requirement that if a child has their custody transferred and then subsequently it makes more sense for parental rights to be terminated and for them to be adopted, that a door be open so that the benefit can follow.
All right. Thank you, Representative Albright. All right. Thank you, Mr. Sellum. Seeing no more questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Mack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a brief question, just again with all the different moving parts, just seeing kind of what we need to pay a little bit more attention to. I'm wondering, maybe you made the comment, Madam Chair, is this the part of the bill that might be raising some issues with the early childhood committee that you had mentioned? Or
Representative Mack, the questions this morning centered around the impact, possible impact in adoption proceedings and placement of children with relatives and whether in the background study piece. It's kind of not so much this committee's jurisdiction, but I can assure you that smart people were all over this issue, and I hear Mr. Sellin say that they've almost got it worked out because there was a problem where it could potentially block children from being adopted by relatives who were very qualified but had some disqualifier that would stop that process. So that's being ironed out, and it was of concern, I think, all around the table in civil law, as these issues so often are. So.
Sure. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Huntley.
If I can just give the one example that was used, a grandmother wanted to adopt the child in this case, and she had had, I think, 4 years before a check forgery conviction. And according to the way the bill is written, she could not adopt those kids because of that. So we're trying to address that and make sure that the, number one, it's the judge that decides whether the adoption goes through. It's the federal government that decides whether the money will go along with that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Huntley. Okay. I think, thank you, Mr. Sullen. And you have another testifier. Hi. Are you on Article 3? Or can we?
Madam Chair, Representative, based on the concerns that people had previously expressed, Marvin Davis is here. But since there were no questions, there's no requirement that he say anything.
Okay, thank you very much, because we have about 12 minutes and we need to get through a couple more articles, so appreciate that. Okay, we're on Article 4, and I think we have Assistant Commissioner Coleman, welcome to the committee. And if you could just do it really quickly, because we really only have 12 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I am Jean Wood from Continuing Care Administration, Department of Human Services, and I'm here on Articles 4 and 5. Article 4 concerns community first services and supports. Legislation was passed in 2013 establishing a new community first services and supports. It is a reform of the existing personal care assistance program. It is a more accessible, it is a more flexible service. It provides a variety of activities. The legislation also required that the department work with stakeholders and with the CFSS Implementation Council on program integrity, among other things. And so this proposal has recommendations that came from that committee, particularly relating to program integrity. And so it gives the authority to establish a payment rate methodology for consultation and financial management services, which are required by CMS to be a part of CFSS, the Community First Services and Supports Program. The policy, there's a policy change in here that allows parents of minors and spouses to be paid as direct support workers. And this policy is consistent with the policy and practice under Minnesota's other self-directed programs, consumer-directed community support, and the consumer support grant programs. There's also language in here to reflect service design and policy decisions for service standards, service delivery, and program integrity, including it establishes billing requirements for CFSS. It limits the number of hours that a caregiver can bill for and be paid. It clarifies financial eligibility when there are overpayments or violations of applicable rules, regulations, and statutes regarding community first services and supports. And there are additional provisions in here that govern background studies.
Okay, question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Woods, I've heard of a constituent has a severely behaviorally challenged child and has had a really difficult time maintaining support services as a result, and who in the past has been able to use a sibling, an age 16 sibling who has an established relationship with that person, and it's actually worked much better than people coming in. And so I think I'll be offering an amendment in Representative Huntley's committee to address that, but I wanted, if anyone had a concern about that, to get to me before tomorrow, because I do think if you have a sister or brother who can knows what the triggers are of someone who has a difficult time maintaining kind of normal functioning, we ought to take advantage of that when we can.
All right, and maybe we could, Representative Loeffler, thank you for that, and I had seen the amendment, and I know where you're going, and maybe we could have that discussion offline because...
Right, I just wanted to give a notice.
Give them an idea that it's coming. And
I had one other question, and that is on page 59, there's a long list of additional prohibited services, and on line 59.10 is giving of injections into veins, muscles, or skin. And since we have so many people who have frail health who might be receiving these services and have diabetes is, you know, directly correlated with particularly some mental health medications and other things, are we saying that you can't have someone who would have traditionally fulfilled the role in the past of a PCA assist with that if the person's disabilities are such or that they couldn't self-administer?
Ms. Wood?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we don't have the information to be able to answer that question, but we can get back to you with the answer.
Okay, appreciate that.
All right, thank you, Representative Loeffler. Other questions, Representative Mack?
Just a brief question, Madam Chair. Thank you. If my memory is serving me right, Articles 4 and Article 5 are included in Representative Huntley's delete all also. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thanks, Representative Mack, for clarifying that as well. Okay, and I also have Deputy Commissioner Ann Barry on my list. I don't know if she's actually wants to testify. Okay, no. Okay. Very good. And then I have one more testifier if we have time. So did you have something more, Ms. Wood?
Madam Chair, I have Article 5, which I can go through very quickly.
Okay, very quickly.
It addresses the Jensen settlement, and the department is required to implement a plan agreed to under the Jensen settlement for the modernization of Rule 40. And Rule 40 governs the use of aversive and deprivation procedures in licensed facilities that serve people with developmental disabilities. And so the modernization of Rule 40 includes transitioning to current best practices and providing services to all individuals with disabilities. It will include the use of social and behavioral supports that are positive, prohibits the use of restraints and seclusion, trauma-informed care, and the development of community support plans that are consistent with person-centered planning. There is another section of Article 5 that is a correction to the Home and Community-Based Services Performance-Based Incentive Payment Program, known as PIP, and the Quality Add-on. And this is cleanup language. It adds home care providers to the list of eligible providers that were inadvertently left off, but the money was calculated to include them. Um, It also corrects a double appropriation for essential community supports. Madam Chair, would you like me to explain the 4% rate increase in quality component? It is.
I think so, Ms. Wood, just because I think when this we talked about this last night in Representative Huntley's committee, I think there were some issues with it. And could you just tell us what page you're on in the bill for that?
Where I'm in that sections 45 and 47.
Okay. In Article 5.
Article 5.
Correct. 45. So, members, I think that puts us on page 116. Sure, if you can do that very quickly, because we only have 5 more minutes.
I can. With the increasing number of older adults and people with disabilities that are living in their own homes and receiving services, it's important for the department to support provider efforts to deliver the highest quality of service possible. Over the last 10 years, home and community-based service providers have generally seen greater reductions in rates than other long-term care providers. And so this proposal would provide a 4% increase effective July 1st, 2014. 75% of this rate increase must go toward workers' pay and benefits. 3% of this rate increases across the board, and 1% is dedicated to quality. That 1% quality increase would be given as the result of filling out a one-page description of a quality project that they might be doing. We would permit them to fill that out online if they do not fill it out. Starting January 1, 2015, we would start deducting 1% from their rate.
Right. And Ms. Wood, I think I can ask the question that kind of came up in Representative Huntley's committee, and with apologies to members who might not be on that committee also, but on line 116.32, one of these ways that the one of the projects can be to deliver good quality service more efficiently. And I know some of us last night had a question about that, why that is considered being more efficient is a measure of quality here in terms of, I guess we just kind of want a little more information about what that means and how that actually helps the person who's being served here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, providers choose many different ways of delivering services, and of course we have a great variety of services that are delivered through home and community-based services, and this section here is to be able to permit a provider to provide us maybe something fairly unique about how they are providing services. And so in a sense, it's almost an other category. There are several things that we have thought about at the department, but we would also be open to listening to items that the provider believes would be a good quality service.
Okay. Representative Loeffler has a question, and then members, we're going to have to wrap it up pretty quickly because we are at the end of our time. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say I think that that really does need to be looked at, and it should be really client-focused. So I would endorse your continuing to look for information on that.
All right. So any other questions for members before we vote on the bill? And this is going to go obviously back to Representative Huntley's committee. I know not all the members here are on that committee, but and I know that those of us who are would be glad to have your take your input. I know Representative Huntley would be glad to take your input if you have further things you'd like to see reflected here, or we could certainly continue the conversation. Any other questions? Not seeing any. All right. Thank you, Ms. Wood. Representative Huntley, is there anything you want to say before we take a vote on your bill?
No, I think we're fully informed and prepared to vote.
All right. Representative Huntley, thank you. I feel like we've very fully informed. We've heard this bill in many permutations. So Representative Huntley is going to renew his motion that House File 3216, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. And you have anything else? There being no more business for the committee, we are adjourned.